This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Raleigh architect Frank Harmon has been sketching buildings and landscapes for decades. Now, he will admit they are not the most elegant drawings, but they help Frank look past the surface and understand what makes a place feel special. And in that way, in the way the sunlight hits a wood porch or the protective branches of an old tree. In 2013, he started sharing those sketches on his blog. And today, the blog posts are collected in a book entitled Native Places, Drawing as a Way to See. Frank Harmon is a fellow of the American Institute of Architects and joins us now. Frank, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us more about the genesis of this book.
Well, I've been sketching since I was a child, and I've always sketched as just part of my life. And so I've got, you know, dozens of sketchbooks on my shelf. In 2013, my wife Judy died. And in the months after, as a way to find my way out of despondency and grief, I thought, well, why not look at these sketches and choose one and write about it? Write about it in a concise way of 200 words or less, that doesn't try to repeat what's in the drawing, and use this as a way to reflect on the world. So the sketch might be of a dustpan or a fire hydrant or of a mountain, but it was very interesting to develop it.
And, of course, these were sketches that you'd been collecting for a while, so
yes,
the way you see it today may not have been. To what extent were you trying to remember what you saw, and how much of it was, what am I looking at right now?
Here's the thing about a sketch. I can take a photograph of a landscape or a building, and I'll forget it. But if I make a drawing of it, I'll remember it forever. I can look at a drawing I made when I was 19 years old in Greece, for example. I remember what time of day it was. I remember who was with me. I remember what the temperature was. So it's a question of finding a sketch and then writing about it. And the knowledge is already embodied in the sketch.
And you have said that you don't consider yourself a very good sketcher.
No, certainly not. I'm not trying to make a beautiful drawing. I'm trying to understand what I'm looking at. The English art critic John Berger said once that drawing is a way to see. In order to really see something, you have to draw it. And so that's why I'm making a sketch.
It gets back to the conversation we had earlier in our last segment about theater, the idea of embodying something. It's more than just an intellectual idea and maybe a faint expression, but internalizing this, the corporeal sense of a thing that's out there. I mean, what do you think is happening there? Why is a drawing, a sketch, which is less representational, let's say, than a photograph, right? Less accurate to some degree, more powerful?
A drawing is a way to capture the moment. You know, so much in our life is of the past and of the future. Rarely do we get to focus on the moment. A drawing typically takes me 5 minutes, but that 5 minutes I have completely to myself. Now, what that sketch embodies, I don't always know. So, you know, usually later I'll come to look at it and I'll think, well, you know, isn't it interesting that all those people were standing outside that pub in London on a Friday afternoon? And I'll start to think about it and write about that.
Maybe I could ask you to give us an example, and you can tell us a little bit about this one. Daniel Webster Greets the Sun.
Oh, yes.
Hand it to you. This is Washington, D.C. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about it, and then I'll ask you if you wouldn't mind to read your reflection.
Sure. Well, I was in Washington to see an exhibit at the National Gallery. I was staying at the Tabard Inn with friends. There was a snowstorm the night before. I got up early that morning, and I just walked around. And as usual, I had my sketchbook with me. And I saw the sun rising, and it was coming straight down Massachusetts Avenue, almost like the sun on a sundial. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? And I made a sketch of it. And here's what I wrote. On the chilly morning of the last day in January, the statue of Daniel Webster faced the sunrise on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, D.C. The sun rises every morning in Washington, of course, but only at this time of year does it shine directly down Massachusetts Avenue and warm the bronze figure of Daniel Webster. For a few seconds, the sun lit his face. Then it was gone, blocked by the buildings on the south side of Massachusetts Avenue, just as a gnomon throws a shadow on the face of a sundial. Cherry trees stood bare in the snow. The ancients measured time and life by the sun. Druids held a midsummer ritual at sunrise on June 21st when the sun aligned with the monoliths of Stonehenge. Our rituals are more recent and unaligned with the sun. Inauguration Day, April 15th, Independence Day. A statue of General Winfield Scott stands across the square from Daniel Webster. After the sun left Webster, it illuminated the figure of General Scott, who faces the White House, half a mile away. A jet left a feather of vapor in the sky.
Frank Harmon, reading from his book Native Places, Drawing as a Way to See. Frank is a fellow of the American Institute of Architects, a Raleigh architect, and joining us today to talk about this book. In so many ways, your book is about connections, about feeling connected to the sketch, the connections that you had to the natural world, and even the cultivated world that you're witnessing. And in some ways, it's also a warning for us not to become disconnected, to find ways that we can connect and not allow ourselves to be detached.
It's an invitation for us to become connected. I'm an architect. People think that architecture is very specialized. But if you walk and breathe, you're in the business of architecture. Architecture surrounds us. The rooms we sleep in, the breakfast table, the streets we walk along. And we all know what makes a good room or what makes a good street that we feel safe on. We know what makes an interesting classroom. We have this instinctively in our background and in our knowledge. And we don't need to rely on experts, architects, interior designers, apps like Pinterest, to tell us what's good. We know what's good. And so my goal is to create a way that we can appreciate and observe the environment that we're in as a way not only to enjoy it, but to make it better.
I'd like to know more about the evolution of those thoughts and your career, because I know you studied abroad in England, right? What kind of career were you planning at that moment?
I thought I was going to be a modernist architect who changed the world, that everything would be new and different. It would be gleaming under the sun. And it was only after about 20 years, and I came back to live and teach in North Carolina, that I started to notice things that I hadn't seen before. Tobacco barns, for example. I'd always discarded them in my youth. I'm from a family of farmers, but I'd never paid any attention to a barn. But I learned that barns are possibly the single best way to observe and understand a landscape, because a barn tells you what grows there, what kind of soil it is, where the bad winds blow from, and what materials are available. So it's like a little introduction to the culture of a place. And I then realized that it was the particular nature of a place that was far more important to making architecture and landscape than an ideology of modernism.
And you've said that you can even tell sort of what kind of tobacco grows from east to west based on the barn you're looking at. Is that right?
Absolutely. You could blindfold me and I'd take the blindfold off anywhere in North Carolina and I'd know where I was because of the barn.
So that suggests that the people who are there understand, you know, so the needs, as you say, which way the barn should face, the orientation of the barn, the materials that you're going to use. Going back to your earlier aspirations in the sort of modern architecture and the expert, I wonder to what extent this is also a commentary on our notions of progress, our belief that things are always somehow, in some way, as they change, getting better, right? And should change for the better. And I wonder if you've had reflections on that and whether or not that's something we should reexamine.
Well, I'm always open to new ideas and new ways of looking at things. But I think at the same time, it's important to be aware of, for example, the embodied wisdom of farmhouses and barns and even textile mills in North Carolina, because the people who made them, they weren't architects. But they knew what they were doing. They knew where the bad winds blew from. They knew where the sun came from. And so if, for example, we look at some of the buildings in Nag's Head on the coast of North Carolina, they're about 100 years old now. But they're as natural and accommodated to their place as a horseshoe crab on a beach.
And, of course, they're adapting to new technology as well. I mean, if you're talking about industrial strength, tobacco growing, right, agriculture and those things, it's not as though technology stands still, but you're saying...
No, it's not standing still.
You can pay attention to the embodied wisdom of people.
Some of the most interesting buildings out there are newer buildings like grain elevators and even bulk curing barns for tobacco.
You also developed a fascination for a cabin in Penland. Tell us about that.
Oh, that cabin was the summer home of Rosemary Harris and John Ely. And what I remember, it's an ordinary cabin along a road near Penland. And, you know, what I remember about it is walking up and smelling wood smoke and roses. John Ely loved a good fireplace, and his house, winter and summer, was permeated with wood smoke. Rosemary Harris planted a climbing rose on the south side of this expansive porch. The porch was really the center of the house. They had comfortable chairs out there, a view down to the valley. And it was a lesson to me that, you know, what makes good architecture? It's not so much the building, but the place that it's in.
And the way you talked about that porch, and apparently it attracted some fairly famous visitors.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember going into the kitchen, and there was a little note on the refrigerator that said, "Rosemary, that was a fabulous breakfast. Larry." I thought, oh, well, that's good, Larry. Well, Larry was Sir Lawrence Olivier, who was one of their house guests. So I thought, wow, yeah. Mountains of North Carolina, wood smoke, and Sir Lawrence Olivier.
Could I ask you to read and reflect on another of your sketches, maybe one that has some, obviously they're all meaningful to you there in that book, but perhaps one that you would choose and to read and talk about. I'm talking with Frank Harmon, whose new book is called Native Places, Drawing as a Way to See.
Well, this one is called Back Porch Mondrian. It's about a screen porch I saw in eastern North Carolina in Elizabeth City. You can tell a lot about a building and its inhabitants by gazing at the front door. Airport doors are curt and functional, reminding us there's little time to waste. A church door made of oak suggests a place to linger, an opening to consider the passage of time. Sometimes the door can be relaxed and friendly to the touch, like this green porch door in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. During Elizabeth City's hot, humid summers, green porches kept the flies out and let the breezes in. The people who used this door painted it many times, probably because it took a lot of hard knocks. The colors have been splashed and rubbed on, washed and weathered by rain, and neglected. We can see that the inhabitants of the house included a dog, and that the unknown craftsman who made the door wanted it to last. Modern doors of metal and plastic are built to look trim and maintenance-free. A wooden screen door with splotchy insets is a counterpoint to neatness. It catches our eye. It's a kind of tattered back porch Mondrian.
Frank Harmon reading from Native Places, Drawing as a Way to See, a collection of sketches and reflections that he has put together in his new book. Obviously, you've brought your experience as an architect to these reflections, but I wonder how the blog and the book itself, but again, you've been doing the blog since, what, 2013, right?
Yes.
Has that changed the way you understand or understood your profession? Have you looked back and wondered about different ways you might approach things?
It has. The architecture profession is burdened with schedule, budgets, time, efficiency. Often architects are put in the mold of having a standard way of looking at things. You know, office buildings should be such and so. A church needs to look like this. But I've become much more interested in the spontaneity of life, the sort of unexpected things. And in my architecture, I've always tried to include those. For me, the front porch light on a house can be as important as the master bedroom in terms of the feeling it gives us.
You in your career, you have the distinction of having designed a building that was voted one of the second ugliest in Raleigh.
It was. I was disappointed it wasn't the ugliest.
Tell us more about that one.
Well, because it's the headquarters for the AIA in downtown, it was meant to be something of an embassy for architecture. Not only architecture, but architecture that would be sustainable and that would make the environment better than it was before. Well, of necessity, a building like that's going to look a little bit different. But if a visitor to the building visitors open their eyes, what they'll see is a building that has many of the same qualities that a farmhouse in eastern North Carolina built 100 years ago had. It has a large porch facing south. It has windows that open and allow the breeze to go through. The building is only one room deep, which means that every room can have light, daylight, from three sides. You know, we never turn the lights on at the AIA building during the day. So even though it's a novel and different looking building, underneath it's got these bedrock principles that I like to think we can all learn from the people who originally built buildings in North Carolina.
Frank Harmon is a fellow of the American Institute of Architects, and author of Native Places, Drawing as a Way to See. Frank, thank you so much.
Thank you.
He's going to be reading from the book at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tonight, 7 o'clock, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.